You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Greg Matloff. Greg, I want to thank you for talking with me today.
Well, you're quite welcome, and once again, thank you very much for having me.
I want to talk about what you're working on now. You've done an awful lot of work. We're also going to talk about collaboration with the arts, but you're a writer and a scientist, and let's talk a little bit about what you're involved in at the moment. Is there a book or writing or particular project you're working on now?
Okay, I'm involved in several things. First of all, I still teach at New York City College of Technology, part of CUNY, in the astronomy program. And I'm also on the advisory board for Yuri Milner's project Starshot. He hopes to send tiny probes to the nearest star on a 20-year trip. I do that because I started off as a rocket scientist and then became a sail scientist because it's a solar sail, actually a photon sail type project propelled by an enormous laser. In terms of books, there are several that I've worked on. I recently, in 2015, did a collaboration with an artist who also is my mate, C. Bangs, and this was on consciousness, and it was something that I came across purely by accident. It was evidence that stars, including our sun, might have a form of consciousness. So the book was entitled Starlight, Star Bright, Are Stars Conscious? We did a second version, an artist book, that C was able to get into the collection at the Museum of Modern Art, as well as to a number of other people. So we've lectured on that in a number of places. I've given a number of popular and scientific talks, including a number of peer-reviewed papers, and I'm hoping for information from a recent, actually a European space observatory called Gaia, which was launched a few years ago, and hopefully this will support the theory. That information should be out within the next year or two.
We'll support which theory, if that checks out?
Okay, basically what I did, and I don't want to get into too many of the details, I sort of gave myself a challenge. And what happened was there was a symposium at the British Interplanetary Society dealing with a very famous science fiction writer, in at least in astronomical circles, a guy named Olaf Stapledon, who was also a philosopher, and he wrote his major books in the 1930s in Britain. And his masterwork is Star Maker. And everybody in the symposium I knew was going to be looking at his technological projections and see how accurate they are. And they were pretty good. And I decided to look into his core philosophy of metaphysics, which was to be something very much akin to what philosophers would call panpsychism, that consciousness pervades the universe. And in his case, he would say that stars have a form of consciousness and a fraction of their motion is volitional. So I went to the web, which is where people do most of their research. I went to Google, and I plugged in anomalous stellar motions. And what came up was something that blew my mind away. It was by a guy, a Russian astronomer from the 1940s and 50s, a guy named Pavel Perengo. And first of all, he knew he had something dangerous, and he wanted to stay out of the gulag. And he realized that the prevailing Soviet metaphysics was extremely materialistic. So he protected himself by writing a mathematical book, and he dedicated it to the most highly evolved human of all times, whose name happened to be Joseph Stalin. So Pavel was safe. And then what he published was that there's a strange discontinuity in stellar motion. If you look at the rate at which stars are moving around the center of the galaxy, cooler red stars, such as the Sun, are moving a bit faster than hotter, bluer, more massive stars. And so I said, okay, that might be what it needs. And what this would mean is that one of the theories of how consciousness comes in is through molecules. One of the things that contributes to the molecular bond is vacuum fluctuations. It's not all electrodynamic. It's these little fluctuations, extremely energetic in the vacuum, and they can't all fit in between molecules, so there's a pressure. And this has been validated. It's called the Casimir effect. And some people have said, okay, vacuum fluctuations might be the most creative thing in the universe. After all, the universe probably is a stabilized vacuum fluctuation. So maybe consciousness comes in through that. So what I had to do is find very good and accurate data on Perengo's discontinuity. I plotted it up. And then I compared it to exactly where molecules would come into stars, where stars begin getting cool enough to have molecules. And sure enough, the discontinuity is right over there, just for stars a little bit hotter than the sun. So we have very good data going out a few hundred light years. It's not conclusive yet. In order for this to really stand up and indicate some type of self-organization in the universe, we have to demonstrate that Pavel Perengo's discontinuity works over the entire galaxy. And that is something that this European Space Observatory called Gaia should be able to do, because they're taking very careful measurements on position and motions of about a billion stars, and the final report should be out sometime next year. And they are sitting on the data, and I've checked this. I've tried to get into their control room in Turin, Italy. They wouldn't let me in. And I contacted somebody who I quoted in the book, an Argentine astronomer, Richard Branham, and he basically said the same thing. We're just going to all have to be very patient. So that's one thing I've been working on. And I've been doing that in collaboration with C-Bangs. She's been doing a lot of the art with it, and I know since you'll be interviewing her, she will tell you how she got involved in doing this particular type of art. The other thing I've been doing lately, another book, which I just started in collaboration with C and with Les Johnson, who is a physicist and manager at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, which is in Huntsville, Alabama. And what we're doing is we're sort of looking at all of the different aspects of alien megastructures. Now, you and some of the listeners might have heard about something called Tabby's Star. There's an American space observatory called Kepler, which has been looking at transits of extrasolar planets across the face of their star. It's been looking at about 100,000 stars in constellations, Kepler and Cygnus. And there's no way that the astronomical team could evaluate all of that, so they form it out to groups of citizen astronomers who in many cases are directed by young astronomers. And there's this woman whose name is Tabby, whose last name is something like Boinahan. I believe she's Serbian, and I apologize to her if she's listening, because I have great trouble with that name. And what they discovered was one particular star which has a very, very surprising and very strange light curve. It's nothing like we've seen before, and one of the many explanations for it is that there is a large structure around the star, a partial structure. And that is something that was also initially suggested by Olaf Stapledon, and physicist Freeman Dyson took it up. So what I'm doing with Lesson C is we're doing a book on this, and we're starting with terrestrial megastructures that, you know, right now I can't imagine reshaping a solar system. But think of little termites who build enormous mounds 50 or 60 feet high. Or think of the slime mold amoeba who gets together with billions of other amoebas and builds a slug that makes its way through the forest floor and releases a couple of cells for reproductive purposes. From their point of view, that's a megastructure. You might also think of the tiny seed that gives you a sequoia tree, or you might think of something that C is fascinated by, a little coral which gets together with other corals and forms the Great Barrier Reef. So we're starting off looking at that, and then we're talking about the basically the history of the thing, people like Stapledon and Dyson, and also a Russian physicist named Nikolai Kardashev, and moving from there to talk about the different searches, the different data, what these things might look like, what the applications might be if somebody decided to build such a thing. And I'm very glad that, you know, Tabby Star is about 1,500 light years away. I don't think I'd want anybody that advanced very close to me, because they might consider us like termites. Another thing I've just started doing is I'm looking to try to apply some of the stuff that Project Starshot is doing. One of the things they're looking at is putting an entire space probe on a chip, a miniaturized space probe on a chip, and putting a sail on that, and the whole thing might be a meter across and weigh a couple of grams. And what I'm going to be proposing in a paper I'll be presenting in a couple of weeks is, why don't we do a little experiment and send the upper stage of a rocket like a Falcon 9 fairly close to the sun, a bit closer to Mercury, and releasing a lot of these things and basically sending them out to the Kuiper Belt, which is where Pluto is. And Pluto has lots of little tiny companions. Some of them seem to be reflective, others seem to be redder than they were expected to be. And I would like to see if some of the smaller ones give any indication of being artificial. We might be living within a partial Dyson sphere established by people by aliens from outside without knowing it. And I'm not the only person who said this. Fairly recently, Avi Loeb, who directs astronomy at Harvard, and Edward Turner, who's an astrophysicist at Princeton, have also come out with a paper on searching the Kuiper Belt for artificial constructs. And these are very exciting things. They're very interesting things. And you never know, you know, what's going to pay off with this. I've done a lot of work with interstellar travel. Small probes, world ships that take 1,000 years to get there. And it's been a lot of fun.
It's exciting. Now, there's you know, it's so complex and fascinating. Also, on a kind of layman's level, what you're saying. I have a few questions for you on this. To begin with, when you talked about the project of the sun and consciousness, there's always different ways of perceiving this, right? As you're talking about it in terms of structure and data, it's understandable without I mean, to the extent that I'm understanding what you're reaching for. But then also to just talk about the sun as a conscious object starts, there's also the popular interpretation of that, which in my case would be, oh, that means the sun can think, the sun could reason and perhaps talk to another sun. But that's not exactly what you're saying either, correct? So what I'm getting at is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's also popular sometimes interpretations that can perhaps misunderstand what you're saying.
Okay, what I tried to do when I was, because I'm very new to the consciousness field, when I was doing the research for Starlight, Star Bright, the book I mentioned, I looked at different definitions of consciousness, and even among the physicists, there is no universally accepted definition. Everybody has his or her own. And so this isn't even counting the philosophers, the psychologists, the neurophysiologists, the anesthesiologists, and all the way down the line. So all I can talk about is a physical manifestation of it, and that is volition. If a portion of a star's motion is volitional, in other words, if it's like self-organization, that I can measure. And it doesn't have to be a very high level of consciousness. It could be something like I would suggest something like a slime mold amoeba. Now, other people don't like that they've said on the Centauri Dreams blog, which is one of the astronomical blogs, one person said I shouldn't use that analogy because slime molds are considered ugly. Why not a flock of birds? Well, okay. It doesn't have to be, for what I'm looking for, a very high level of intelligence. Now, other people disagree and think it might be an extremely high level of consciousness. There's a physicist science fiction writer, very famous guy, Greg Benford, who I am very happy to call him one of my friends. And Greg did a book a number of years ago with Gordon Eklund called If the Stars Are Gods. He's now coming out with a second edition of this and is going to be crediting me with, I guess, the ideas that I talked about before. And yeah, what he does is he plays with the idea that stars and maybe other objects are more conscious, they communicate with each other, and it's at a higher or different level than human consciousness. It's also something, there is a fellow in the early 1980s, he had worked on the Club of Rome, which basically predicted all of the possible catastrophes for about this time, some of which we're seeing. And his name was Eric Jansch. He died prematurely in 1981. And just before he died, he published a book called The Self-Organizing Universe. And he feels an object like a star or something else could be conscious if there's an energy source with organized energy at the center and less organized energy or higher entropy energy is given off from the outer components. And he figured that the star's consciousness would be right in the upper layer, which is where it would have to be for there to be molecules. But it's very interesting to look at that. And he doesn't just say stars. He says a star-like object. The planet Jupiter gives off more energy than it receives, about 30% more energy. And we've even discovered recently that dwarf planets like Pluto and the asteroid Ceres, the largest of the asteroids, seem to have active surface geology, so they may have to be some type of energy source internal to them, probably some type of radioactivity, but who knows. If that's true, you may have to bring the definition of consciousness for a celestial object down to something smaller than a star. And that's very interesting. But, you know, once again, I don't know. The only thing I can talk about measuring as a scientist, as an astrophysicist, is stellar motions with this and to see if the discontinuity is uniform around the entire galaxy. And if anybody else could come up with a materialist theory about why this discontinuity occurs just about or exactly at the place where molecules come in. So.
You know, there's it's fascinating, and there's so many things that are, you know, that I was saying earlier have to be translated a little bit for layman to understand. As you were talking in the second part of our talk about alien structures, one of the things that struck me was a question I've always had, and if it's fair to ask here, it is what I never quite understood is if the universe is in fact infinite. I mean, I know that's a theory, but I can't imagine it quite being closed. But if it's infinite, shouldn't we have already seen other kind of extraordinary alien life forms? Shouldn't they have, in a sense, and again, this is just my lay understanding, but have already contacted us by now if the universe is in fact infinite? Because that would account for almost every possibility, wouldn't it? Or am I really misunderstanding something?
No, you are understanding this perfectly. This goes by two terms in astrophysics. In 1946, the physicist Enrico Fermi basically said, "Where is everybody?" Because he was able to demonstrate even then that using early nuclear energy, we could think about interstellar arcs traveling between stars, take on millennial trips and supporting this civilization. And this is called the interstellar paradox or the Fermi paradox. Now, also, the people who search for extraterrestrial signals in SETI haven't found a definite one. And Paul Davis another famous cosmologist calls this in one of his books, the eerie silence. And what some people, they've tried to come up with answers for this. And these are paradoxes. We don't understand a lot. One group says, well, maybe everybody is listening and nobody is transmitting. And the reason for that is they know that, you know, we might transmit and say, we're here, we're your friends, we have peaceful intentions. And the other group picks up the information and says, boy, do you sound delicious. And they come to that planet and eat them. You can't rule out, you know, we like to think they're altruistic and they're like us. But our concept of altruism might be species dependent. We evolved from primates and before that the great apes. But what if we had evolved from arachnids, from spiders on a low gravity planet? There's no reason why spiders couldn't ultimately develop intelligence. After coitus, in many species of spiders, the female bites off the head of the male. The praying mantis female does the same thing if she can catch her mate. So that would be considered altruistic, not what we do. So I think I can understand why different races are being careful that way. And the other way with interstellar travel, if you're sending a group of starships, so called world ships, because they would probably, inside at least, look very much like a planet on a small scale, like the one that's in the movie Interstellar at the end. And we always, in science, many science fiction, they come to the Earth, they look at our Earth is beautiful, let's go and take it over. Well, wait a minute. There was something like 200 or 230, whatever it is, possible proteins, possible amino acids. And terrestrial life uses only about 22 or 23 of these. So if somebody's coming to look at our Earth from another Earth-like planet, the chances are that their biology would not be very good on the planet Earth. They really couldn't adapt to it. So very likely they would simply colonize the outer reaches of our solar system and leave the planets alone, except maybe if they got in the mood, they'd come and send a couple of UFOs to abduct humans and experiment on them. Who knows? But, you know, it's like we might be, being a life-bearing world, we might be very special. But other life-bearing worlds may have significant differences in their biology, so they couldn't just come here and take over. And therefore, actual visits to our planet might be very rare.
Mm-hmm. So you said there's two camps of thinking. So that is one camp of thinking for why the eerie silence.
Right. There was another camp, and these, of course, are the UFO people. And I know some folks who have actually done scientific work to try to evaluate UFO cases. The one guy who I know is Eric Davis, but Jacques Vallée in France, who died a few years ago, and, oh, Hynek, I forget his first name, in the United States, who also passed away a few years ago, did very careful analysis of UFO cases, and they figured out that something like 6%, whatever it is, of these cases cannot be explained. You can explain most of them because of unusual atmospheric conditions, secret government projects, what have you, but there is a residual number of cases that are very hard to explain. Perhaps we can't explain at present. And so other people have said, well, you know, if they are light years away and it takes 1,000 years to travel from the nearest star to here with a large ship, they're not going to be too many aliens coming to the solar system. But if they have over the last 4 billion years or so of the solar system's existence colonized a portion of the Kuiper Belt, let's say, we can't really detect this at this time, or further out the Oort Comet Belt, they could occasionally come into the inner solar system for whatever reason. And you cannot, this is a minority group, but you can't rule it out. And all you have to say is that, you know, scientifically, we're beginning to explore the Kuiper Belt and we'll see what happens. Right now, the probe that was originally directed to go to Pluto, the New Frontiers probe, flew by Pluto, which is a dwarf planet in the Kuiper Belt. It used to be a full-fledged planet, but it was demoted, and its large satellite, Charon. And it's continuing to a second destination, which is very small, about the size of Manhattan Island. And it may be very reflective, and it might be a binary or more. So I believe it's called MU69, but I probably am wrong about that. So I think it gets there in a few years, and we just have to keep our fingers crossed. And we'll see if this is a natural object or if we're finally at the point where we'll start discovering intelligent life from elsewhere. And it should also be mentioned, it doesn't have to be organic life. Some people, those involved with singularity research, say that when in a few decades, certainly perhaps within a century, computers should be complex enough that it might be possible to upload the human essence, whatever that is, into a computer and have a form of machine immortality. And it's not impossible that as time goes on, even human beings might merge with machines. So whatever we find might be a machine intelligence rather than an organic intelligence.
That's fascinating. It was enlightening talking to you, and I before we go, and I really could keep talking to you for a while, but perhaps we'll talk again, and of course I'm going to be interviewing C. Bangs next, which will also reflect on some of the things you've been saying. I want to ask you what you've been reading, and the question I ask everybody at the end, it could be off topic or not.
Okay, I've been reading two very interesting books. One is, I've been rereading this, is very deep, by Thomas Nagel, a philosopher at NYU, called Mind and Cosmos. And basically what he's doing is arguing that the prevalent materialistic neo-Darwinian conception of nature and the universe is almost certainly false. He's not completely in favor of panpsychism, but he thinks it's an improvement. The other one I've been reading is a very clever book. It is called Mr. G, by a physicist named Alan Lightman. And I mentioned StarMaker. StarMaker looks at the creation of the universe from the point of view of, it's Stapledon's book, of a galactic entity of consciousness permeating the universe it gets together. This book does the same thing from the point of view of the creator of the universe. Mr. G, of course, is Mr. God, and it's a very clever book.
I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, you're very welcome.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.